It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station from beautiful and breezy downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 59 degrees. Out at the airport, they are showing steady westerly winds at 25 miles per hour, gusting to 33. And they have 10 miles of visibility. Sunny, breezy conditions today with a high near 64. West winds continuing at 30, gusting as high as 50 today. Partly cloudy overnight tonight with a low of 55. West winds continuing at 30, gusting as high as 40. And for tomorrow, sunny skies, high of 72, and those west winds are expected to come down to 20 and finally down to 5 tomorrow afternoon. Coming up on the Midday Report, a Kenai neighborhood has been suffering from flooding, and the borough is taking legal action against a resident who dug a canal to try to alleviate it. And Juneau, how threatened are they by floods from the Mendenhall Glacier? Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Georgia prosecutor spearheading a racketeering and conspiracy case against former President Donald Trump and 18 of his associates is proposing the defendants be arraigned the week of September 5th. Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis has also officially requested that a judge set the trial date for March 4th, 2024. That's just 8 days before the state holds a Republican presidential primary. Indictments in Georgia and Washington, D.C. are related to Trump's alleged attempt to subvert the will of the people and overturn the results of the 2020 election. Trump also faces charges involving his handling of classified documents, hush money payments, and was found liable on civil charges of sexual assault. Trump has disputed all of the accusations as politically motivated. Trump was indicted yet again this week. It has not made a difference with many or most Republican voters to this point, it seems. But NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports Republican candidates are grappling with how to handle Trump at their first debate next week, whether he shows up or not.
Trump is refusing to sign a pledge to support whomever the Republican nominee is after the GOP primaries, and that's one of the requirements of getting on the debate stage for the Republican Party's first debate next week in Milwaukee. That throws into limbo whether or not the party's frontrunner for the nomination will even be there. Other campaigns are having to prep for the debate with Trump top of mind, and they're going to have to figure out how or if they'll talk about the quartet of indictments that Trump is now facing and the 91 counts against him. To this point, leading opponents of Trump have been reluctant to explicitly go after him using the allegations. That may have to change if they hope to have any chance to defeat him. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
Seeking re-election, President Biden celebrating the anniversary of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, designed to bring down health care costs, promote climate action, and boost tax collections.
We created more jobs in 2 years than any administration has in a single four-year term.
Republican critics argue the legislation would make inflation worse. The fires on Maui not only have destroyed the lives and homes of many, they've also put the economic engine of the island, tourism, in jeopardy. NPR's Jason DeRose has the latest.
Immediately after the fires, the message from elected officials was, "Don't come, it's not safe." That upset many who make their living from the travel industry here, hotel workers, restaurant servers, surfing instructors. But that earlier message has shifted more recently. Here's Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson.
Please don't go to the west side of Maui. Don't go to West Maui. Obviously, there's so much going on with trying to rebuild it. But the rest of Maui is still open.
Still open for business. Last year, nearly 3 million visitors spent almost $5.7 billion here. More than half the island's jobs are directly related to tourism.
It's NPR News. After 2 days of heavy fighting, some semblance of calms returned to the Libyan capital. Security forces are patrolling the streets of Tripoli. Local media report that rival militias began exchanging gunfire Monday. The violence that claimed at least 45 lives in the Libyan capital this week underscores the power struggle that's grown since the late dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and later killed more than a decade ago. A utilities commission in California has voted to allow driverless car companies act like taxis in San Francisco, but as NPR's Derek Kerr reports, they've faced resistance from emergency responders.
The San Francisco police and fire departments have been vocal about their opposition to driverless cars. They say the vehicles have impeded first responders' operations, running through yellow emergency tape and blocking firehouse driveways. Here's San Francisco Fire Chief Janine Nicholson.
Our folks cannot be paying attention to an autonomous vehicle when we've got ladders to throw.
Nicholson has been urging California's transportation regulator to halt the growth of driverless vehicle programs in the city. But in a 3-to-1 vote, regulators decided to allow the programs to expand. Now, autonomous vehicles run by Cruise and Waymo can pick up passengers and charge a fare, just like a taxi. Dara Kerr, NPR News.
U.S. stocks ended the day lower. The Dow closed down 180 points, roughly 0.5%, to settle at 34,765. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org, and listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Just south of Kenai, a neighborhood separated from Cook Inlet by the highway, has struggled with surface and groundwater flooding for over a decade. For one resident, ongoing frustration with the borough and fears about flooding led him to dig a canal. As KDLL's Riley Board reports, the borough took legal action against that resident and his canal this summer.
For several months, K-Beach residents have been speaking out at borough assembly meetings about the impacts of flooding to their homes, properties, and septic systems. Borough Mayor Peter Michicki says K-Beach Road acts like a dam, keeping water in the neighborhood and impacting homes and properties.
You know, like everything else around here, K Beach went from a trail to a gravel road to a fairly modern highway, and we're to the point in the evolution where we understand that inadequate passage of water is becoming a long-term problem.
Resident Dave Uregi took the flooding problem into his own hands, digging an unpermitted canal that crossed borough property. The borough filed a cease and desist in September and a notice to stop work in November. The State Department of Natural Resources filed another cease and desist in June. On July 14th, the borough filed a lawsuit seeking a restraining order and injunction against Uregi to make him stop work on the canal. In the lawsuit, the borough planning director assesses that the ditch could release 2 million gallons of water into the neighborhood, causing widespread property damage. Michicki says he was reluctant to take legal action and wants to maintain a collaborative approach to the issue going forward. But he says the digging was straightforwardly illegal, and eventually the borough had to step in.
What the injunction does, it just tells that individual to stop. Let's work together. Let's make sure the right experts are involved. Let's, as a community, design and execute a long-term plan. But you simply can't take it into your own hands.
Uregi, on the other hand, sees his efforts as a favor to his neighbors. He spent the last 10 years tracking flooding in his neighborhood, working with a hydrologist to figure out the best solution, and occasionally using his heavy machinery to move land. In 2013, flooding in the neighborhood led to a disaster declaration and $1.26 million in federal relief. In 2014, Uregi threatened the borough with a lawsuit, asking it to take action on the flooding. He owns hundreds of acres, including a ranch, air park, and undeveloped residential subdivision.
I've been working on it hard, steadily. Nothing's changed. Other than we're much more aware of what the impact is on people's residences now.
Uregi has been perpetually frustrated with what he sees as inadequate and inconsistent action from borough and state entities when it comes to the flooding issue.
This is a borough-maintained road. They're supposed to have a ditch that conveys water to the inlet or the river. Well, they didn't do it, and it was 10 years.
Last year, Urigi excavated a ditch along Eastway Road. He says as a plumber, he was concerned about how flooding could impact his property and his neighbors. When he was hit with the first cease and desist last fall, he says he didn't accept the premise.
When we flooded here on the ranch, Eastway Road started flooding. I didn't have any problem at all going out there. In a flood situation, the cease and desist and all of the borough's BS goes out the window. It doesn't matter. In a flooding situation, the community has a right to protect themselves.
This spring, he widened the ditch. The injunction was filed in July, but Urigi says he has no intention of backing down. He wants someone from the borough to listen to his ideas and take his solution seriously. In response to the injunction, he filed an affidavit in objection to the borough's claims and is considering filing a lawsuit of his own. The case is still waiting on a ruling. Machicki says the borough has made progress this summer on lowering some water in the area and plans to work with state agencies and an independent hydrologist on a long-term solution. He emphasized his goal of a collaborative approach.
I hope we can do it as a team and not two different sides. We know we want the same objective. We want to help people be successful and on their property in the Key Beach area, and the only way to do that is to do it together.
Urigi is also taking collaborative steps with other Key Beach residents. He's bringing the neighborhood together to discuss mutual experiences and solutions at a community meeting this week. In Kalifornsky, I'm Riley Board.
Juno is at the mercy of the ever-evolving Mendenhall Glacier. Each year, water captured behind a glacial ice dam releases into the Mendenhall River, causing a flood. Typically, the flooding is minor, but this year, floodwaters tore through the Mendenhall Valley with more force than ever before, gnawing through the riverbank and undermining homes that once seemed safe. A few days later, a small group of scientists took a helicopter to the source of the flood to figure out why this year's flood was so devastating and to see what that might mean for future floods in Juneau. KTOO's Anna Canny went with them and has this story.
Hydrologist Aaron Hood is shuffling across patches of vivid blue ice. He and two other scientists follow a silty channel that runs between a steep mountain slope and the edge of Mendenhall Glacier.
So this last week we would have been all underwater here.
They're headed to a glacial basin known as Suicide Basin. It sits about 2 miles above the glacier's terminus. Just a few days ago, 13 billion gallons of water drained out of that basin and carved through here. Then it spilled down to Mendenhall Lake and out into Mendenhall River, which rose 9 feet in a matter of hours. It was the worst glacial outburst flood in Juneau's history. The team moved towards the mouth of the channel, weaving through small streams of water and dripping, house-sized blocks of ice that were left behind by the flood. After a steep ascent over loose boulders, they're standing at the lip of Suicide Basin. It's a deep, bowl-shaped valley, dwarfed by peaks surrounding it. On one end, the vast expanse of the Mendenhall Glacier. The glacier here acts as a dam, trapping rain and meltwater in the valley. Before the flood, it was filled to the brim. Now, it's empty. That's because when the water builds up enough pressure, it cracks through the ice. Then it works its way through those cracks, out under the glacier, and downstream to the Mendenhall River, triggering the flood. That same process has happened every year since 2011. But Hood has been studying the glacier at the University of Alaska Southeast for more than 2 decades, and he remembers a time before that.
When I moved here, there was no waterfall because it was all ice, but the entire basin was filled with the glacier, so there was no room for the water to fill up.
But the glacier is receding rapidly, in part due to human-caused climate change. So that's what revealed the basin in the first place. And as the glacier keeps melting, it continues to change the size and shape of the basin. Understanding how it's changing can help scientists better predict future floods. At the basin's edge, Hood lays out a miniature helipad and a small drone. The drone flies back and forth across the basin over the course of a few hours. It takes thousands of aerial photos to capture every crack and crevice. Even when it's empty, the basin is filled with huge chunks of ice that were left behind by glacial retreat.
So that's a big concern, is that the more all of this ice sitting in here can melt, the bigger the flood's going to be.
And scientists believe that the ice is melting faster than ever. At the same time as the glacier melts, it's pulling back from the edge of the basin, making it wider. That means there's both more meltwater and more space to store that water. So there's the potential for larger floods. But that's only one factor that determines how bad a flood will be. Hydrologist Ed Neal of Alaska Hydroscience says the trickier part is understanding how fast the water drains from the basin.
You know, you got X amount of water. If you let it out of garden hose, it's going to take a long time to drain it. If you let it out of fire hose, it's going to take a short time to drain it.
This year, it was more like a fire hose. The water drained fast, causing a higher flood peak and more damaging flow. But the drainage channels where water comes out are buried in tons of ice. They're basically impossible to get to. This leaves scientists with an unsolvable equation. With the drone survey, they can only find one variable, which means predicting Juno glacial outburst floods will remain a bit of a crapshoot. What they can say for sure is that another major glacial outburst flood will come. Hood says that the threat of flooding will remain until the Mendenhall Glacier melts away to a point where it can no longer dam the basin.
This flood will probably occur for decades. It's unlikely that we would have experienced the largest flood within the first 10 years or so.
Meanwhile, extreme rainfall is becoming more frequent across southeast Alaska. If the next big glacial outburst flood coincides with a drenching rainstorm, the damage could be even worse. So the residents who live along the bank of Mendenhall River shouldn't expect a major flood every year, but they should expect something worse in the coming decades, because high above Juneau, the basin keeps growing. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Hibernation scientists at University of Alaska Fairbanks have invited colleagues and students from around the world to a workshop in Fairbanks. They have reviewed each other's findings indoors and headed up to Tulik Lake Research Station at the Brooks Range yesterday for outdoor lab work. KUAC's Robin has this report.
Already, they've been to a supercooling lab and done several hands-on experiments.
It's been pretty intense.
That's Dr. Kelly Drew. She's known for her groundbreaking work in drugs and cryogenics. She's one of the coordinators of the two-week summer school, along with Brian Barnes and Oyvind Toyen, who's giving a lecture here about bears.
Whether it's ketamine involved or not.
About three dozen scientists and students have come to share and hear the latest discoveries.
They're from everywhere. We were so excited to see the international interest.
They've attracted quite a lot of people throughout the world right now, and it's making quite a buzz.
Nirhal Lal came from Scripps Research in San Diego, where he works on understanding brain circuits in mice.
The applications are immense, what understanding hibernation can bring to medical science. Most of the diseases what we are struggling with right now, heart diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, I think answers to those will lie in these kind of research.
Hibernation occurs across the world. So how has Fairbanks, Alaska, and UAF specifically, become an international center for hibernation research? Credit the Arctic ground squirrel, which was discovered in 1989 to lower its body temperature to below freezing and survive. That discovery by Dr. Brian Barnes rocked science. It also seeded subsequent research in cryogenics that could benefit emergency medicine and space travel. Domenico Tuponi is here from the University of Bologna. He's studying thermal regulation with Dr. Kelly Drew.
We work on hibernation, and I'm interested in what the animal and the species that are present here in Alaska. And I'm studying thermoregulation, and the interest in hibernation is directly correlated to the study I'm doing.
Matt Andrews teaches at University of Nebraska, which is using molecular biology of hibernation to develop therapies and medicines for humans.
We've had success at developing a therapy for hemorrhagic shock. So when a person has profound bleeding, like in vehicular accident or a wartime injury, and they lose a lot of blood, this is a way that you can put the cells of their body into like a hibernation-like state so that you buy time to get them to the hospital.
Horan Tao is a graduate student from Yale University.
This hibernation workshop really
brings together the hibernation community. So for me, as one of the newest people in the field, it's nice to actually hear from Brian, hear from Ovi and Belt, all their research. It's really nice to see the whole community and how we were doing in hibernation field.
This week, the workshop heads up to UAF's Tulik Lake Research Station for lab work on Arctic animals. For KUAC, I'm Robin.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
What retailers are saying about the U.S. consumer. I'm Nova Sapo with the Marketplace Minute. Target says second quarter sales were down 5% as consumers spent more time outside the home, such as at concerts and movie theaters. Yesterday, Home Depot also reported lower sales. Walmart releases quarterly results tomorrow. The human toll from the wildfire disaster in Hawaii continues to rise, and a risk modeling firm now has an estimate of economic losses. Karen Clark and Company predicts more than $3 billion in insured property losses alone. The union representing workers at Detroit's Big Three automakers plans to hold a strike authorization vote next week. United Auto Workers says negotiations are progressing too slowly. I'm Nova Sapo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate leasing and management. JLL.com.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 16th day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 6:35. It won't set again until 9:50. That will give us 15 hours and 14 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 41 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 41 degrees set in 1970 and then again in 2018, and our record high was 80 degrees set in 2019. Currently 59 degrees, it is fair and breezy. They have visibility of 10 miles at the airport. They're calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high near 64, west winds to 30, gusting to 50. For tonight, partly cloudy skies, low of 55, west winds to 30, gusting to 40. And for tomorrow, sunny skies, high near 72, west winds coming down to 20 and finally down to 5 tomorrow afternoon. And look for mostly clear skies on Thursday night, low overnight Thursday of 49, west winds continuing about 15. And sunny skies on Friday, too, high near 63 with those west winds continuing but light. They're also calling for partly sunny skies on Sunday. Saturday, rather. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up this afternoon at 3:34 p.m. here on the east side, which will be 7.2 feet, followed by a low tide at 8:55 p.m. of 2.1 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 3:54, just about 4 p.m., and be 12.6 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 9:43 of 2.8 feet. Well, here's our new announcement from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 31, date issued 10 a.m. on August 16th. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Thursday, August 17th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 19th in the following areas. In the southeast Afognak, Paul's Bay, Paranosa Bay, and Shuyak Island sections of the Afognak District, the Cape Alitak, Humpy Dead Man, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, and the mainland district. There will be a 72-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 16th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 19th in the following areas. In the southwest Afognak, northwest Afognak, Raspberry Strait, and northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District, the outer Iakulik, Halibut Bay, Sturgeon, and outer Karluk sections of the southwest Kodiak District, the northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and inner Uyak Bay sections, will remain closed, the northeast Kodiak District, and the east side Kodiak District. As previously announced, there will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, August 16th until 6 p.m. Friday, August 18th in the following areas. In the Duck Bay section and the Iseuit Bay section north of a line from Haystack Rock to Biller Cape. The Intercarlic section of the Southwest Kodiak District will close to commercial salmon fishing at 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 16th. And closed waters will be the normal closed waters as described in regulation. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the Southwest Fog Neck section of the Fog Neck District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Cost recovery fisheries began in Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 5th, and fishery opportunities in the Duck Bay, Iseuit Bay, Inner Katoy Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability of the Regional Aquaculture Association to meet cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak district south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart and detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Gale warning today on our east side, west winds to 35 knots and seas to 10 feet. For tonight, west 30, seas to 9 feet, and for tomorrow, west 30, seas to 7 feet. Over in the Shelikoff Strait, gale warning today there as well, southwest 35 today with 11-foot seas in the Shelikoff. For tonight, west 30 with 9-foot seas, and for tomorrow in the Shelikoff, west 30, seas to 7 feet. Here are some meetings coming up in the Kodiak Island Borough. Tonight's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission has been canceled, so there will be no meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission tonight. Tomorrow, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. On Monday, the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting, also in the Assembly Chambers. That's happening at 3 p.m. on Monday. On Tuesday, the Parks and Recreation Committee regular meeting is happening in the Borough Conference Room. That's happening at 6 p.m. on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, the Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting over at the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center's conference room. That happens, as usual, at 5:15 p.m. You can help the Kodiak History Museum create their next temporary exhibit, which is Objects Uncovered. Join them for a public focus group event on Saturday between 1 and 2:30 p.m. at the Kodiak History Museum. Objects Uncovered will feature a variety of stories alongside each object. The focus group participants will look at each object, answer and discuss a series of questions about it, and content from the focus group will be displayed in the exhibit to show how one object can elicit different ideas and stories. If you'd like to participate, just show up at the Kodiak History Museum Saturday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. If you have any other questions, contact the curator, Lynn Walker, at curator@kodiakhistorymuseum.org or at 907-486-5917. Erskine Avenue will be paved Monday through Wednesday. That's happening, and it will be open with flaggers on Monday for congregate meals and curbside pickup at the SCOC. On Tuesday, Erskine Avenue will be completely closed, and curbside meals will be available at the Griffin Building parking lot across from Iluhtik Museum from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Seniors are encouraged to pick up a meal at this site instead of coming for a congregate meal. Congregate meals will be available for those walking to the senior center. And CATS bus is also unable to get beyond Erskine on these days as well. So no congregate meals at the senior center on Tuesday. For Thursday and Friday, weather permitting, Erskine Avenue will be open as usual. For more information about all this, call the Senior Center at 907-486-6181. And the Kodiak Elders Coffee Tea Hour is happening next Wednesday, August 23rd. That goes on from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m. upstairs at the Nekoniag Conference Area over on Near Island. Transportation is available. If you'd like transportation or more information, contact Elder Services at 907-486-7352. And if you haven't heard yet, the Kodiak High School class of 1973 is still planning their reunion dinner on September 2nd. For more information, contact Janelle at 425-879-7067 or Terry at 907-654-7713 and help spread the word. That's the high school class of 1973.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.